such as the UN and the World Bank. And we all remember 4 or 5 years ago some of the outrageous statements being made by some of the NGOs, particularly groups like the UNFAO, that were blaming biofuels for global hunger as if hunger never existed before the advent of biofuels. And they made these accusations, strangely enough, knowing full well that the world produces twice as much food as we actually consume. So on that note, I'm happy to say that we've had some success tempering some of the statements coming out of those organizations. And recently, the UNFAO confirmed that we have the ability to produce 25% of the world's transportation fuels without impacting food prices. Those are their words. So they've come a long way from the outrageous statements of 2008. We've like to think we've had some role in trying to temper those statements. So while we've had plenty of success, obviously there's a lot more to do in educating some of these groups. And with your support and support of these gentlemen here, we will continue to do that. So there's my ad for the GRFA. Let's get down to business here. We have a lot of experience on this panel. We would like to pick their brains on some of the issues facing our industry. But first, the only formal part of this panel will be, maybe we'll go around from the far end towards Bob, and maybe each person can introduce themselves and maybe talk a little bit about what your number one pressing issue is with respect to the global industry.
Okay, thanks. I'm Paul Anderson from Novozymes. We are not a fuel ethanol producer, but we are a supplier of biotechnology and enzymes for the fuel ethanol industry. And we are proudly supplying 60% of the enzymes currently used in corn ethanol production here in the U.S. So what we are doing is providing biotechnology that helps enhance ethanol yields, total economy of production in corn ethanol production today. Furthermore, we are on our way into cellulosic second-generation biofuels, trying to enable the biotech part of that equation. So that's kind of the perspective we'll be happy to bring to the table today.
I am Elizabeth Farina. I am the president of the Brazilian Sugarcane Industry Association. I'm former professor at the University of São Paulo, and I used to teach microeconomics for more than 30 years. And also, I was the president of the Competition Policy Authority in Brazil, so market has a special meaning for me, as you can imagine. And you asked about my first priority. I'd like to say that I took this this place on December the 1st, so this is my first appearance in the international arena, and I thank you, Bob, for inviting me. It's
thank
a
you.
Pleasure to be here. I would say my first target is to work for fostering markets growth. To have larger markets is the main issue that we have. Not only in Brazil that we have a huge market, but also an international and global market. This panel is about global trade, and we firmly believe that this is what our main subject is. So I think I would say fostering and protecting programs like RFS. You gave me your button. I should have put here.
I'll give it to him.
It is here. I think we have to support programs like RFS, California programs. We have to support EU directives and fight against to reduce them. And also, we have to fight for the programs in Brazil, like Flex Fuel Cars program that already uses 25% blend. So this is my first priority, to get, let's say, a larger market instead of having a larger market share over a small market. Thank you.
Good morning to you. My name is Rob Fiat. I'm the Secretary General of the European Ethanol Producers. I'm something like Bob, but then in a slimmer version. Oh, it's small after all. Bob, thanks for having me here. I would like to leave the stage alive and the room, so we don't get physical, do we? Okay.
Insulting your host is a good start.
Yeah. It will get better. For us, the most pressing issue is, and I really envy your slogan, Bob. So Bob promised me to help me on finding a good slogan, is to avoid that Europe is going to mess up with its biofuel policy. I'm really concerned. And I think there is where the RFA and ePure have a common agenda. You need to avoid that the RFS is going down the drain and we have exactly the same problem in Europe. But we discuss trade as well. Don't you worry. Thanks.
Thank you very much. My name is Scott Thurlow. I'm the new president of the Canadian Renewable Fuels Association. I was put in this position on April 2nd of 2012, and so then the drought started. So please feel free to blame me. In addition to market access on a global perspective, we're also interested in protecting the brand of renewable fuels. And I'm not only talking about ethanol, I'm talking about biodiesel and the next generation as well, because our membership is more than just the producer of ethanol. We are the entire life cycle of renewable fuels, including replacements for diesel. And so yesterday I was speaking at the NBB. But I would like to make sure that everyone in this room understands just how integrated the Canadian economy is with the American one. And when you guys go through an economic downturn, it has a resonating effect into Canada, which has a very deleterious impact on our economy, and that includes our renewable fuel sector.
Thanks, Scott. We're keeping our penny, though. I'm Bob Dineen. I've been with the Renewable Fuels Association for some 26 years. When I started with the industry, I was even more thin than Rob Verhoed is now. It's true. As our industry has grown, so have I. I want you people to slow down. No, I don't. I really don't. I don't. Bliss asked the question, what is our number one objective when it comes to trade? Ours is, as I said earlier, to open new markets all around the globe, as Elizabeth had indicated, to build demand globally. Today, that means trying to tear down some of the barriers to ethanol use that are arising, whether that's in Europe with a RED program that says no food feedstocks, or some of the trade actions that some on this panel have taken. But we're going to do everything possible to build an open and larger market for all of us. I'm not interested in cannibalizing Scott's producers, Rob's producers, Elizabeth's producers. I think our collective target needs to be displacing petroleum all across the globe. That's what our target ought to be.
Thanks, Bob. Some of you may be familiar with Canada's tradition of peacekeeping. And so this seating arrangement here is very strategic. And we have our fellow Canadian here between Mr. Verhoed and Mr. Dineen for a very good reason, because Scott may have to assume that role as peacekeeper when we talk about our first issue.
Wait a minute. Being a Canadian, he's certainly a fan of hockey. So if there's a hip check to get him out of the way, don't be surprised.
I may be looking for volunteers to be my linesman.
Can we switch chairs?
So Rob, we're going to get into this trade dispute in a second, but the oil industry will get over $400 billion in subsidies this year, and I can't remember the last time we had a trade action over between. Being driven by the oil sector against jurisdictions that are being subsidized, et cetera. So I find it a little bizarre that we are in this spat that we are today attacking one another. But let me throw the floor over to you, Rob, and maybe you can explain to me what were you thinking?
That, Your Honor, is a leading question.
That's a leading question.
What were we thinking? Well, interestingly, Bob, in his opening speech, he said some nice things. He said, well, nice things, he said some things. First of all, that Brazil should not, I used your favorite word, cannibalize the American market. And they can do that because they have the RINs. I would like to remind you that you were doing exactly the same with us. You used the VTEC to get into the European market.
Not true.
Yeah, okay, that's what you said all the time, but the investigation showed that it was the case.
No, so, Rob, the investigation on the anti-subsidy case found that the subsidy had gone away, and that's why you lost the anti-subsidy case. Rob, what we're talking about is an anti-dumping case.
Now, hold on.
It's got to be real here.
Don't interrupt me all the time because...
All right, I'll only interrupt you when I have to.
This is like watching tennis.
Now, the anti-subsidy investigation clearly established injury in our markets. Like, you don't want your factories to close. We don't want to do that either. We want to keep our people to have their jobs. So it's completely legitimate what we were doing. And you are spot on. It was a legal argument why, in the end, we lost that particular case, because the VTEC was abolished. You made that point already earlier, and we said, well, let's take the gamble. Maybe we lose, maybe we win. But on the dumping, you lost, and we won. So I see this
not
as...
yet. It's still going on.
Well, no. I mean, the decision has been taken. You probably will need to go to Geneva to fight the EU, saying that they violate GATT rules. Well, that's you're entitled to do that. But I see this as a nice compromise. We lost something, you lost something, we won something, you won something. So let's bury this whole trade affair now, and let's move to things that are really, really important. So I agree with your statement that our governments should fight for us. They should not work against us. And that is the main challenge we're faced with.
Well, you're wrong in that the EU determined that there had been injury from the subsidies. They hadn't. They didn't, when doing that investigation, clearly establish that there had been product that had received the tax incentive that got to Europe. In fact, the tax incentive that was available was only available for ethanol produced here and sold here, because it doesn't go to producers, remember. It went to gasoline marketers, not our industry.
Absolutely.
Now, might there have been a trader or two that figured out some way to manipulate the trade code or the tax code and gain access to that? It's possible. But it was on the margins, and it would have been very small, which is one of the reasons why you lost the subsidy case. But you cannot dismiss the fact that when the EU began its anti-dumping investigation and they investigated 5 or 6 different ethanol companies, they found no evidence of dumping. But they want to ignore all of that. They weren't clear on what it was that they were investigating, whether it was fuel ethanol or beverage ethanol or industrial ethanol. They didn't do a proper investigation of the European companies to determine whether or not there was injury. In fact, quite frankly, they ignored everything that they had gotten in their investigation, and out of frustration that they had lost the subsidy case to what they viewed as a technicality, they decided to ignore decades, if not centuries, of trade law and just say, we're going to impose a countrywide anti-dumping subsidy, when that is a violation of WTO. It's a violation of every trade concept that has ever been established. If there's anti-dumping, you're supposed to impose a fee to penalize the company that's doing the dumping. You didn't find any, and you're penalizing everybody. And ultimately, you're penalizing your own consumers. Because here's the thing, Rob. Your own industry can't meet European demand, which is why, for years, Brazil was supplying 25% of your market. And when Brazil's the price of sugar started to go up, when the U.S. became the low-cost producer in the world, we began to make up that supply. if you can't meet your own supply, and you tell the U.S. industry you're going to have to pay 25 cents a gallon more in order to come in here, the only thing you're doing, Rob, is hurting your consumers.
Well, I totally disagree with that, Bob. I mean, we're not hurting the consumer at all, because the consumer doesn't notice whether there is ethanol in the fuel or not, and certainly not at the pump. The price is not...
The consumer's going to notice the price.
No. That may work in the United States, but not in Europe. Forget it. But coming back on your subsidy story, if you think that there was no injury, why did you welcome the outcome of the investigation? Then you should have been consistent and say, you proved injury, but you were wrong. No, you said, we welcome the decision of the commission not to follow up on this one and to drop the case. Now, on the anti-dumping, we did not do the investigation ourselves. It was the commission. It was signed off by all the member states, and you know, they're always very, very nervous if there are GATT rules involved, and they agreed. So now, if you're not happy, and I understand you're not very happy, there is another legal way to fight this.
Which is why I said, don't think that you've won this yet, because the U.S. ethanol industry indeed is going to continue to fight it, and the American government is going to continue to fight it, because we're not going to watch the European Union unilaterally rewrite trade law. And I'll tell you what, we're likely to find support from other countries around the globe that are going to be equally concerned about the European Union taking an anti-dumping investigation and ignoring the investigation and deciding to put a countrywide tariff in place. Because if you can do it to the United States, you'll do it to Brazil. You'll do it to Canada. You'll do it to China if they ever get producing. And that's why we are going to continue to fight it as an industry and as a government.
Instead of spending your money on very expensive lawyers, maybe you should spend your money now on lobbyists working on the Hill, and we're going to do the same. So my proposal to you is, Bob, and I think I can reach you, I'm not sure, could be a risk, that we just bury this whole trade dispute and we will continue to fight what we really need to fight for, which is a bigger market. I mean, globally, I'm happy. Now, we can supply our market because we were underutilizing our own capacity, you know perfectly well, and the gap you're leaving is going to be filled by new plants that came on stream last year. So,
Scott, you wanted to weigh in, and then we'll switch topics here.
I did. Canada and the European Union are currently in the final throes of negotiations of a free trade agreement between the two countries or geographic areas. One of those things is an aggressive tariff reduction on biofuels. Our position is always going to be on the most open and accountable model for these types of trade disputes to be resolved. And I would posit that using our governments in negotiations is ultimately one of the best ways to solve these types of trade remedies. But tariffs, in any way, shape, or form, are just taxes on consumers domestically.
On that note, let's switch topics.
I'm sure.
Go ahead.
Maybe just one final point.
I don't know.
Because you raised it. Evidence to the contrary notwithstanding, we're actually very good friends. And 2 years ago, we got together after this event to play some golf. It was Rob's first time playing golf, actually. And he did a phenomenal job for somebody playing golf in
a suit.
In a suit. Put us all to shame dress-wise. But I actually made a prediction at that time. Do you remember what it was? That if you engage in this trade action, the only thing you're going to do is make a bunch of lawyers wealthy. And that's indeed what you've done. So I do so hope you're happy.
The lawyers are, I can tell you.
We can get back to this in a minute. Let's switch gears for a second, away from policy for a minute and towards some commercial developments. There are a lot of companies around the world doing fabulous work right now developing new technologies to move our industry forward. And with this panel up here with a global reach, we'd like to just find out from a few of them what are some of these exciting commercial developments. And Paul, you've got lots of reach into China and areas like that. We'd love to hear from you about where are some of these exciting commercial developments that we may be not reading about yet.
Yeah, we are a global producer and supplier of enzymes, so we work in all regions of the world and before getting to China. I like to say that the U.S. has clearly been at the forefront of creating a renewable fuels industry, being the world's largest producer today. And in addition to continuing to crank out more corn ethanol, getting towards the 15 billion gallons, the next big thing, as I guess you all know, is going to be advanced or cellulosic biofuels. And what we will see happening is next year a number of plants coming up, starting to produce cellulosic advanced biofuels here in the U.S. Brazil is also an example of a country taking up or taking the next step of moving from first to second generation biofuels, and also a lot of things are happening there. To China, it's actually worth noting that in addition to the relatively small corn ethanol production they have today, they have a handful of corn ethanol plants that produce the equivalent of roughly 2 to 3% of the gasoline pool in China. They're also leaping towards cellulosic biofuels, advanced biofuels. And actually, the world's first truly commercial cellulosic ethanol plant started in China in the autumn of last year. It didn't get that much publicity, but it's standing there and it's producing at a cost that's fairly close to corn ethanol. So we do see these things actually starting to happen, and we do see that as the next wave coming on that will take the industry further.
And Elizabeth, you are going to benefit from some great Canadian technology down in Brazil from Iogen. Be interesting to know where that whole project is at and other commercial developments down there.
Yeah, I think Brazil... The industry in Brazil is committed to this new generation ethanol based on the bagasse of sugarcane and straw. And we have this Grajal Bio starting commercially in 2013, so this year. And we have other projects that are planned to start on 2015, at least four or five of them. And all of them are partnerships between Brazilian companies and international companies. So it's what we say, a global business. And I would like to mention as well the improvements that have been done in the traditional technology as well. So we have a road to go exploring this technology. And I would mention this year, 2013 is the last year of burning in São Paulo State, for instance. And this was a voluntary program that required a lot of technology going on. And all the green fields started mechanized, so burning is declining very rapidly. And also we could mention a lot the development of new varieties. As you know, we have very traditional areas in Brazil where most of our production comes from, but we have a frontier, and the varieties of sugarcane were developed for the traditional areas. So a lot of development can be done still with the traditional technology in these new areas. And we could mention also a lot of investment in technologies to reduce the emissions due to vinasse. So what I would like to say is our ethanol is getting better and better with the traditional technology, with a lot of improvements, and with this new technology that we are committed to.
And Scott, I always like to think Canada punches above its weight on many things, but in particular in this area of next gen technologies, there are some great companies in Canada that are doing groundbreaking work. What can we expect in commercial developments in Canada?
Well, first and foremost, like many of Bob's members, our traditional ethanol producers are also looking beyond traditional corn ethanol into more advanced biochemicals, corn oil extraction to create biodiesel, and also, you know, that next generation of cellulosic ethanol from a variety of feedstocks. But I think one of the most interesting members that we have is a company that Mr. Coleman referred to in his remarks earlier this morning when he talked about Enerkem. who have developed a technology where they can actually take municipal solid waste and ultimately convert that into a fuel that can be burned. Their primary location is in Edmonton right now. It's going to be coming online this year. And that's the absolute heartland of traditional oil and gas in Canada. And I think that's testament to the integration that we see between our two industries. It's just so adversarial up here. I don't know why.
Not always going to be that way.
Rob, you look like you want to weigh in.
I think there's going to be a lot of agreement on that.
Yeah, I would like to make a few remarks on advanced biofuels, or well, you call it advanced in the United States, but it's sugarcane ethanol. We have a different definition in Europe, but cellulosic ethanol. Now, I think we should welcome very much what Novozymes is doing here, because they're doing great things. And I believe that, indeed, going to those better-performing biofuels is a kind of political bargaining chip. We need to do that. We don't have any choice. But I agree with Elizabeth that first-generation biofuels is a damn good product, and we can only get to the second through the first. Bob, you made this morning very, very clear that the food for fuel, that's a fabrication. It's total nonsense. But in Europe, they are so upset about all of this that they now believe in this dream scenario that there will be a huge amount of cellulosic ethanol available, which is not going to be the case. Well, look at the United States. How much time did it cost and how much money to get where you are? The EPA was always too optimistic about what could be real in the market. And I fear that Europe is not learning from what the United States is now showing. We need to learn from that. And we are now putting in place absolutely the wrong instruments to get there. I don't believe in those instruments. And I think Paul will probably say exactly the same, that what they are now proposing is not going to work. We need to be extremely careful. We need to get there. And I believe that what we're doing is the right way forward, but don't throw away something that is very, very good and that achieves great, great emission savings.
Rob, that's a good segue, actually, to an issue I wanted to talk about. Bob mentioned it in his speech this morning, and I've got my button here. Don't mess with the RFS. But it'd be interesting to hear from panelists. The RFS has been under attack for a little while. Bob has been spending every waking hour fighting a rearguard action on defending the RFS. But what's happening in other jurisdictions? Are we finding the same kind of attack on the RED in Europe or in the Canadian Renewable Fuel Standard? Brazil has a long-standing support for high levels of blending in Brazil, but are these mandates under attack in other jurisdictions as well? I just throw it open to anybody.
Well, I can certainly start from the Canadian perspective. I would say that on the corn ethanol side, we aren't seeing that overt attack. There are some instances where there are questions about where and how the blending will occur and what the total mandate is. We have a 5% blend in Canada, but the reality is that in most of Ontario, we're blending at almost E10. We're blending at E9, E10, depending on the season. On the renewable diesel side, there are some areas where there are being attacks, where they're seeking regional exemptions, where they're trying to roll back the type of fuel that will be included. In the current example, we see a petition to waive the mandate as it relates to heating fuel, which we find completely baffling to us, because there's no economic case that can be made for it, and there's certainly no environmental case that can be made for it.
Yeah, I think the Brazilian program has faced a lot of challenges, and I think maybe you could learn from the experience of Brazil. First of all, we had a very successful program based on flex fuel, and as you know, we have a blend of 25% that was decreased to 20%. Our law provides a blend from 18% to 25% in order to be flexible. And this is very, very old, let's say. And so we have this blend of 25%. And all the car makers in Brazil came from abroad, so they know how to build cars running with 25% ethanol, anhydrous ethanol, very well.
And really?
Really.
I find that stunning. And is there no CRC report in Brazil that says that these vehicles can't run?
Can't run, yeah. And look, we had two very different experiences in Brazil. The first, alcohol car that was dedicated to this fuel. And at this time, during the 80s, late 70s and 80s, we built all the infrastructure to have pumps that could fill the alcohol cars. And at that time, consumers were, they decided which fuel to use in the moment they buy a car. Today is totally different. The second phase of our program is based on flex fuel cars, and you can run from E100, so only ethanol, to gasoline. With the same car, you decide in the pump looking at relative price. This is amazing because the car makers are the same. So Magneti Marelli, for instance, developed a software not for Fiat, but for Volkswagen, to develop these flex fuel cars. And what happened is that today, Brazilian consumer has a real choice, not in the moment that he buys a car, if he buys a flex fuel car, but in the moment that the price changes. So this is, I think, an achievement. What's our main challenge? Is that sometimes our government is too much concerned with the gasoline price and changed the rules. And that's what I mean by you could learn much from the Brazilian experience, because in the moment the rule changed, the investments in new mills went out, disappeared. Look, we have a lot of investments, but new mills can only return when we have some certainty, not on the price, because this is the business, but on the rules. So take care when you want to change rules.
I don't want to usurp Bliss's role of asking questions here, but I just have a couple.
Go ahead.
Don't allow it.
I've been to Brazil, beautiful country. I've seen all those cars running on 25% ethanol, and it warms my heart. And I do see the logos on those cars, Chrysler and Ford and General Motors, and it does make me scratch my head. But I also see that in Brazil, there are well-trimmed lawns, and there are boats. Do they also run on this 25% blend?
Motorcycles, yes.
Oh, wow. So you mow your lawns on a 25% blend. So all those small engines are running on this dangerous fuel.
Dangerous fuel.
That I find fascinating. I do think that we've talked about some of the policies in Brazil. And one of the things that frustrates us is the way that Brazil has manipulated its marketplace at times in moving the blend ratio down to 18 to 20%. Mm-hmm. I know that the country is now committed to increasing it to 25 again in May. I wish you could do it tomorrow.
Me too.
You too. So we agree on that.
Yeah.
We're going to find agreement here. And I do think that ultimately Brazil needs to stop regulating the price of gasoline and let the marketplace go, because by regulating the price of gasoline, they are constraining investment in your industry and keeping your price artificially low, which has an impact on world trade markets as well. So what we need to do is work together to address some of those barriers so that we can have real and fair trade across the globe.
I think we have. I would like to invite you to come with me to Brasilia, because I think your agenda is very similar to myself. the UNICA's agenda regarding the blending. Of course, our law provides this flexibility, but of course, we always fight for the 25% blend to stay. And I think this a free market would be much better for us. I mentioned the internal market than some control on prices of gasoline. But in the international arena, I think that Brazil has a zero duty for imports of ethanol, as you've done with your secondary tariff as well. So these days, I think we have a kind of free trade between our countries. And this is very clear when you take a look at the numbers, what happened after these free markets start working. So we are talking about 2011, 2010, 2012, 2013. And you see that in the same year, you export and you import. The other year, other way around. What happened is that we are complementing ourselves. When you have problems with your harvest, I can sell to you. And vice versa, when we have, and we had very strong problems with our harvest, you export to Brazil. So, and in the same year, you see the other way around as well. So what I think we can learn from this is having a free market. We can take the opportunities that quality specificities opened to the businessman. Also, logistic problems in order to improve the supply of our fuels. So we have many motives, arbitrage basics of any market. So we have many motives to have this trade freer and improving our markets. This is my Liz, view.
Yeah, Rob, you want to weigh in and then I'm going to switch channels.
Could I ask Elizabeth to say to Volkswagen that the software they were mentioning, to send it to Germany as well? Because I think they forgot to do that. Volkswagen refuses to make any E85 car in Europe. And they are, well, I believe the second biggest car producer in the world or still the first. Now, there is not much I can learn from either you or from you, except maybe around the issue of flexibility. You discussed it this morning as well, and you have it, of course, with your 20 and 25. We don't have that kind of flexibility yet in the European law, but maybe we should introduce it. Now, for the rest, it's all different. But Europe is complicated, Bob, as you know. If we look at the market, the fuel market, we have 80% biodiesel and 20%, maybe a bit more, of ethanol. And what we see is that the gasoline market is shrinking, in your case too. And that is hitting us very, very hard, because the entire discussion we have in Europe on the food has to do with soy coming from Brazil, from the United States, Argentina, and that causes a real problem. And ethanol, which is relatively good performing in terms of emissions, even if you would include indirect land use change factors, that we are being punished for the fact that there is a problem with biodiesel. And we cannot get that resolved because European car manufacturers, they believe in diesel. They believe in that. So they want, we are hugely short on diesel. We need to buy diesel from Uncle Putin. And we need to sell the gasoline to Uncle Sam. Otherwise, we're screwed.
Rob, let me switch channels and back. I want to go back to China for a minute, because China in the last 10 years has dominated just about every sector on the planet.
Uncle Mao.
And, okay. But, but you know, they're very quiet on biofuels. And the question I have for the panelists really is when it comes to markets and new markets, is China a threat or an opportunity? And that's been a debate around a whole bunch of issues in the economy when it comes to China. But on biofuels, we haven't really had that discussion. They seem to be the sleeping giant. You know, I throw it out to the panelists about whether or not this is a huge opportunity for the industry, or is it really, or are they a threat? Powell, you are a resident China expert here.
So now everyone is looking to me, even though I'm not Chinese. Well, for us as an international company, China is one of the markets we're in. So for us, it's an opportunity, just like we have big businesses and opportunities in the United States, Canada, Brazil, Europe, and in other parts of the world. So far, China has been playing this a bit on their own, but they're really shaping up on what they're doing. And we expect to see China developing a lot in the coming years. I don't think it's going to be a threat to the rest of the world. I think it's important in all of this, looking at what's happening across the different regions, that we look at what we're doing in the different parts of the world, and we learn from the experiences in the different parts of the world. And one thing we clearly see is, and this is not rocket science, this is kind of stating the plain and the obvious, is that you have sound, clear, logical programs in place for whatever you want to do in biofuels and renewable fuels. I think China is an example of an area shaping that up. The U.S. has had the IFS for a number of years, which has been a fairly clear and solid legislation. Now there's discussion on cellulosic storm maybe weathering around this whole thing. But it really illustrates the principle that you need to have these solid schemes in place.
Do you see production in China taking off at some point soon?
Yes. Today there is a handful of plants in China producing corn ethanol, these roughly 2 to 3% of the gasoline pool. And the plans of the Chinese government is, in fact, that by 2015, 9 plants with a total capacity of more than 150 million gallons of cellulosic ethanol should be up and running. And the goal is that by 2020, 1.5 billion gallons of cellulosic ethanol is to be produced in China. So obviously a big opportunity.
Yeah, I think that China is really a great opportunity here. First, what Paul is saying, I think technology-wise they can establish a lot. And they could become the front runners in terms of cellulosic technology. But they're also an opportunity, and I'm talking now to Bob and to Elizabeth, for new markets. That is the new market you need to sell your ethanol to. Just don't focus on Europe. I mean, we have nothing to offer you. Yeah? Go to China. They need it.
We'll go wherever there are opportunities, and China certainly is one of them, absolutely. I do think that one of the issues that Elizabeth and I can work together on is to make sure that wherever in the globe it might be, whether it's China or in Europe, that we're not talking about good ethanol versus bad ethanol. The cellulosic ethanol and other advanced biofuels most certainly going to develop, and I welcome it. It's going to happen. But as you said earlier, Rob, the grain ethanol industry today is a darn good industry. And one of the things we need to be working on together is making sure that Europe's RED program does away with this nonsensical, you know, no food crops, including sugar and corn, and so that all biofuels can compete equally. China has really had sort of the same issues a few years ago, declaring that its investment in biofuels is going to be from non-food feedstocks. And they're missing such an important point. It's not about feedstocks. It's about the land use, and it's about the fuel and energy security. We're producing both. But we need to do so much more collectively as a global industry to make sure that we are not a house divided.
Rob, there's one issue here that our industry has talked about for many years, and that's energy security. And we know that in the U.S., it's a national pastime to talk about energy security, so we're quite familiar with the issues here. But Rob, I mean, you know, if anybody should be debating this issue of energy security, it's Europe. You get the vast majority of your oil from the Middle East. You rely on natural gas from Russia almost exclusively. This, you would think, would be a burning debate there. I wonder, you know, in Canada, Brazil, is national security issues, is it a front burner issue still? It was several years ago when oil hit $147 a barrel. Where is that issue now in Europe?
Well, it's not there, and I don't know why. It is as like the Europeans are kind of ostriches who put their heads into the oil sand. I mean, they cannot get it out anymore. The security issue is simply not there. Neither is the agricultural issue, like in the United States and in Brazil. In Europe, it's all about climate, greenhouse gas saving. And I think that, again, the day that Uncle Putin is turning the tap and he said, I'm not going to sell you any more of my diesel, which is a very polluting diesel, we will have really an issue and we will not get it resolved. And then people will awake. And then they say, oh my God, we need to import 80% of our fossil fuel needs, and 98% of all our cars are running on fossil fuel. And that will stop. And then climate change is not an issue anymore. And then it's about getting fuel to the pump.
Elizabeth, Brazil has talked about energy independence. Brazil has talked about energy independence for some time. I think you may, I think President Lula may have even announced that Brazil was energy independent at one point. Is that still an issue? Are you still energy independent? Is that still a front burner issue there?
I think it's always an issue, a political issue. But I think we have both. Nowadays, we need more investments. But Petrobras is involved in a huge project, as you know, in the Pre-Sal Petroleum. Of course, we have to put a lot of money there, a lot of research, and we started doing this. But of course, this was very important issue related to the ethanol development as well, mainly in the 70s. But nowadays, we have this problem not only based on security or this kind of issue, but because we have a special complement to the fossil fuels in our market, and at the same time we can get better environment. So we, as you know, we have huge metropolis like São Paulo, number millions and millions of cars, traffic jams, and if you put 5% more ethanol in your gasoline, you improve a lot your air and decrease your problems on health. So these are the issues that I think moves the Brazilian program as well.
Could I follow up on that a little bit, maybe more directly? One of the reasons Brazil, President Lula, a few years ago was able to declare that Brazil was now energy independent was because of the large finds of petroleum offshore that Brazil is now trying to tap into and are building refineries to process. Has that had an impact on the country's political support for continuing to promote biofuels in Brazil?
I don't think so. I don't think so. We need lots of investment to put out this petroleum. And I think they are more complementary than substitutes. And I think, of course, there is a lot of debate today in Brazil due to the royalties and the distribution of these royalties around the country. But I think this is not what is moving the backwards or forward the ethanol program.
We've got about 5 minutes left. I noticed our clock just came on a few minutes ago. One of the things I wanted to do just before we wrap up, if we finish a minute early, maybe we'll have time for a question or two from the floor. But to each of you, maybe we'll start with you, Bob, and go right to left this time. What do you see as being the biggest development for 2013 for the industry? And then number two, what issues, if any, do you see emerging this year that may keep you up at night?
Well, the two issues, I think, in terms of globally, we're most certainly going to continue to fight my good friend Rob and the European Union on that anti-dumping case. We're going to do that. Secondly, I think we're going to look for ways to build new markets elsewhere across the globe. And in that endeavor, I welcome the support and the help of my colleagues here on this panel, because it is in all of our interests. So earlier, Elizabeth was kind enough to invite me to Brazil. I will publicly accept, but absolutely I'll go. And we ought to start talking about how we can collectively build worldwide markets.
Scott.
From my perspective on the global edge, I think that the threat of poorly founded policy in any jurisdiction where it can gain a toehold is a threat that will resonate to our entire industry. And that's not limited to the ILUC scenario, which is, of course, also going to affect Canadian canola as well as other Canadian biofuels. But the food versus fuel debate, and we heard it from Bob this morning, our champions are getting tired of that conversation. And I think it's up to us to reinvigorate our champions and find new champions to stand up for a fuel that really is here to protect our planet.
Yeah, well, good news for you, Bob. We will not continue to fight out on trade issues because we see it as resolved. The major, major issue for us, as I said before, is making sure that an already very complicated law in Europe is going to get even more complicated. We need to fight this, and I really need your support to get there. I mean, it is important that we, the Americans, the Europeans, and the Brazilians, that we agree that what they want in Europe is wrong, is dead wrong, and we need to. And I fully agree with what Scott is telling about ILUC and the food discussion. It is all ignoring the huge benefits we are producing with animal feed. It's simply ignored, and it makes me very, very sad, this entire debate. And so we need to get some support from you guys.
Okay, regarding global trade, I think this discussion on food and fuel is getting worse and worse. Yeah. And we have read the FAO report, the preliminary report. And I would say when we take a look to the Brazilian reality, we see that the growth and the expansion of sugarcane agriculture is improving our capacity of producing, because we are growing on pastures, former pastures that are very, very low intensive. Can you imagine one cattle per soccer court? One. So this is a kind of reality that we have. And also degraded lands. So when you put sugarcane there, you intensify the production, you increase production, productivity, efficiency, and control the emissions, because you retain in the land the carbon. So this food versus fuel in Brazil is difficult to accept. And we have many scientific works and the reports and the researches made on this subject. So it's quite like a nonsense discussion for our reality, for what we produce there. And I would say for the next year, we will increase our production in at least 60 million tons of crushed cane. So this translated in ethanol production is an increase of 4 billion liters. We think on liters in Brazil, but 1 billion liter gallons. Mm-hmm. And this is enough to supply the increase of the internal demand related to this increase in the blend to 25%, and also to fulfill the RFS2 requirements. So I think we can help you somehow.
And last but not least.
Thanks, and I would agree to what was said already, that I think the most important thing in 2013 is really making sure that programs are in place that will continue to provide the foundation for renewable fuels going forward. And I think two important battlegrounds are going to be the U.S. defending the renewable fuel standard, making sure that we can get past the blend wall, and also in Europe, making sure that we get our legislation right. And to do that, I think it's important that we continue to talk about the benefits that renewable fuels has brought already, and how we can work on making that even better.
Thank you, Paul. It looks like we're slightly over, so I'm not sure we have time for questions. But let me say thank you to the panelists again for bringing us their insights from around the globe. Despite our obvious differences on some issues, we still have plenty in common, and that's why we continue to work through the Global Renewable Fuels Alliance and continue to work on those areas where we do have things in common, and continue to arm wrestle behind the scenes on those issues where we have differences. So please join me in thanking the panelists for today. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And before I shove Rob off the stage, I will. We are friends. Here's a handshake. We love you, Rob.
I can't move you, man.
No, you can't move me.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Elizabeth. Appreciate it. Thanks for being here. Thank you.
All right. We're going to move to one of my favorite parts of this event every year, and that is the Washington Insiders panel. And we've got, come on up, we've got a great group again this year. Some of them are some familiar names, among them Marty Durbin, who is the Executive Vice President for Government Affairs at the American Petroleum Institute. Marty has been with us several times in the past, always does a great job representing his client. Before joining the API, he was with the American Chemistry Council and the American Plastic Council. But in a previous life, and I don't know if he has completely disowned this part of his biography or not, but he once worked for Nebraska Congressman, I'm sorry, Illinois Senator Alan Dixon, who was a great man.